You reach the second floor, where you find a bronze gate. Inscribed on it are the words, "Ahead of you lies the terror of PC Engine."
Welcome to the second floor of Doors and Dungeons. And by second floor, what I mean is second season, but I was trying to figure out, well, season sounds kind of dumb for everybody does seasons, right? So I was like, what can I do different? And someone said, you should do floors because it's a dungeon. I'm like, that's a great idea. So you are now listening to the second floor of Doors and Dungeons. Welcome back to 2019 and got some new stuff. Ready to go for 2019. Got that book that I've been working on that is down to the last 30 pages of editing. So I hope to give that out in the next few months. That's the goal with that. I've also got a fun project that I'm putting together. It's going to be a video series. I'm going to call it the 90s Challenge. And basically the goal with this is to go for about a month and make videos where for that entire time I live with no technology made from the year 2000 or after. So it's going to be all computers from before 2000. It's going to be dial-up internet if I can ever figure out how to get an actual dial-up service that will connect properly. We're still working on that. It's going to be, you know, no movies, no media from after 2000. So I'm not going to be watching any, you know, I don't know, whatever movies came after 2000. You know, I'm going to watch in like Aladdin and some crap like that or something, you know, and listening to CDs and having portable CD players everywhere I go and not having a phone everywhere I go and not having the internet everywhere I go and, you know, all that fun stuff. Except for, of course, when I'm at work because I have to use it for that. But that's a project that I'm going to be doing later on this year, so stay tuned for that. At some point, either this year or next year, there's going to be an entire series on Ease. And what else do I have? I'm working on a project right now where I'm restoring a 486 machine, and that's going to be a video. That's almost finished. That was sent to me from Australia by an awesome friend here who sent me his family PC from when he was a kid in Australia through the mail. It cost a decent amount to do that. And then I'm also working on a restoration project for a PC88MA. Which is going to be a video as well. So, yeah. And then later on this year, at some point between now and August, I will be moving. So that's going to be fun, and I don't know when that is. It may cause some delays for the podcast. If that happens, I will let you know. But now it's time to really delve into the second floor. What awaits us? Well, today on our inaugural episode, what awaits us is the PC Engine. And to talk about the PC Engine, I have here someone that I'm calling Professor A, because I couldn't think of any other, we couldn't think of any other nicknames that would get past the iTunes adult content filter. Yes, so this is Professor A, famous for Aetherbyte, which makes games for the PC Engine.
Yay, hi.
Cool. And so we're going to be talking to you today about the PC Engine because, hooray, it's an actual console. For the first time in this podcast history, we're going to an actual console. Now, the first question you might be asking yourself is, what's a PC Engine? And first thing you could say, when if someone asks you, what is the PC Engine? I guess first thing you could say is it's a TurboGrafx-16. But what would you say to someone who asked you, what is a PC Engine?
Well, obviously the obvious answer would be that it's the TurboGrafx, but the Japanese version. But if I had to actually explain it to them, I would just tell them it's like the Sega, but nobody bought it.
In America,
yeah, right.
In Japan,
right,
it's the reverse. In Japan, it's like the Sega, but everyone bought it.
Right. I would just explain it as the closest we came to arcade perfect games in the 90s for a long time.
That's true.
That's still the way I describe it to people, because I've had people actually ask me what, like at work and stuff, they go, what's a TurboGrafx? I'm like, it's a PC Engine. Like, what's a PC Engine? I'm like, where were you during the 90s? They don't know about it either way. So I can't use the, it's a TurboGrafx explanation. So I have to explain to them, you know, it's a 16-bit machine. It came out, you know, around the same time as Super Nintendo. And it's like, the thing that made it stand out is that the games, like the color count on the screen, made it more similar to the actual arcade games than the other machines were at the time. And I explain it as that, and the fact that it's super compact and cool looking. Like, to me, it's still the most, like, I guess, like, cyberpunky looking machine of the era. Like, if you think of, like, Snatcher and stuff, like, the PC Engine hardware fits the bill way better than the Nintendo's and, like, Genesis and stuff never really quite.
Well, the Nintendo especially, the Famicom looks like a kid's toy. I mean, it really does.
Right, right. Yeah.
So that gives us a lot of great starting off points here. I guess the first thing to explain about it is the history of it. You said it came out around, you know, the same time as Super Nintendo. I guess that may be true in America. I'm not sure.
Right, right.
But in Japan, it's definitely not.
Oh, yeah. And in Japan, yeah, it predated that, because it came out in 1987, because we just did the...
Yes.
It just had its, like, 30th birthday thing that we did. That's where we released that one game for it. It's funny, if you think about it, actually, it's when it came out, it was kind of like the Super Nintendo, because it was like the Famicom, but better.
Exactly.
So like the Super came out. That's I never thought about that. It's really...
Yeah, so that's one of the interesting historical things about this system, is that this system is actually super advanced for when it came out. And a lot of people... Mm-hmm. It's funny, because it's very opposite of its image in America. But in Japan, this thing came out in 1987, which the Famicom came out in 83. So this is like 4 years after the Famicom. It's competing with the Famicom, but graphically it blows the Famicom just completely away. And so this is a collaboration, I guess you could say, between Hudson and NEC, who a lot of people listening to this should know now from the PC-98 or the PC-88. It's a Nippon Electric Company, I think is what it actually stands for. But anyway, they produced a lot of computers and a lot of parts and things like that. And, you know, they made these PCs in Japan, mainly at this time the PC-88 and also the PC-98. But the 98 was a lot less advanced by this point. And they were, you know, computers for the average, you know, businessman to have. But what they were noticing, I think a lot of those computers were selling game software way faster than they were selling, you know, actual productivity software.
Right.
And so I think NEC saw a real opportunity to get into the games market, because from what I've heard, the story is that Hudson developed a graphics chip in-house that they thought was just really awesome. And they took it to Nintendo and said, hey, Nintendo, can we, you know, put this in as an add-on for the Famicom or for your next system or whatever? And Nintendo kind of passed on it, which is in itself a little bit odd, since Nintendo always, you know, worked pretty well with Hudson. But apparently they passed on it. And so Hudson kind of shopped it around, and Nintendo said, you know, hey, yeah, NEC said, hey, we'll take that. Yeah, we'll do that. Have you heard anything, like, specific about that?
I mean, I don't know, like, extreme specifics, but basically, you know, like you said, they tried to sell their sweet graphics chips to Nintendo, and Nintendo was like, nope, pass, which is interesting because, you know, a lot of, like, the most popular Nintendo games were, like, ones that had extra chips in it.
Yeah,
including, I think,
especially.
Like, the mappers and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why... I don't know what possessed Nintendo to pass on that. Only thing I can think of is like that they were probably like, no, dummies, we have our Super Famicom stuff being designed, so we don't need your thing. But man, what a mistake.
Really?
Because that's the thing, like I said before, the thing to me still to this day that makes the PC Engine stand out, you know, is the color count that you can get on the screen. Like, you can get 482 colors on screen. There's like too many, really. Like, that's why so many games, like, if you look at the side by side, the certain games, like the PC Engine ones always look more vibrant. It's because, you know, you can have 16 different sprite palettes, yeah, and they each have 15 colors. Like, there are 16 colors, but the first color's transparent, so you never physically see, you can't see it. And the backgrounds, every tile, there's 16 palettes. So you have 16 sprite palettes to work with, and each one has 15 colors. And, I mean, that pummels what the other machines can do, and that's why all the games just look super, like, vibrant.
Yeah, and the other nice thing, too, is that even if you have it on composite video, which a lot of systems look really, really trashy on composite, the PC Engine still looks really, really good.
I think part of that's because the only way you get composite out of a PC Engine is either, like, the AV booster or the interface unit, where it's, like, extra hardware to do the composite stuff. It's not just, like, on the board. Because, like, the Genesis and stuff, you know, there's so much interference. Like, my Sega Genesis.
Oh, Genesis is awful.
Oh, yeah, you had to, like, tilt the TV and touch the cord the right way to get all the static to go away.
I know. I was a friend of mine, the same friend that sent me that computer I was just talking about from Australia. He just bought a Genesis, you know, Mega Drive, as they call it here, a couple days ago. And he brought it over because he was like, hey, I want to see, this thing looks, like, you know, looks really bad on my TV, and I want to, like, compare it with yours. I was like, okay, yeah, sure, bring it over, we'll see. And he's like, is this all right? And I was like, yeah, that's just the Genesis being awful. Because I compared it, like, I showed him my system and, you know, showed him that it's the same thing. But then I compared it with the RGB, because I have an RGB on mine. I showed him the RGB, and the difference between RGB and composite on the Mega Drive is just insane. But the difference between RGB and composite on TurboGrafx, if you mod for RGB, is surprisingly not that huge of a difference. I mean, it's definitely a cleaner signal, but it's the PC Engine to begin with has a really clean signal.
When we were demoing stuff that we made at there's a local game convention I always go to called CCAG. Mm-hmm. The one year I had two Commodore 1084S monitors and an Amiga 1080 monitor. So those are, like, pretty popular RGB monitors that people know about. I was just running composite through them with all my systems because they have composite on them. I just plugged them all in. This dude came over. He was like, oh man. Like, he's like, I love RGB modded systems. These look so great. And I'm like, these aren't RGB modded. This is just stock composite TurboGrafx stuff. Like, one, I had the American TurboGrafx and CD set up, and then a Super Graphics and a PC Engine briefcase. That was what I, or maybe it was a Duo R at the time. That's what I was demoing our stuff on. And it's like, dude, it's just composite. And he was like, whoa. And I'm like, yeah, the Turbo Graphics, all the PC Engine consoles composite is just great, like, compared to anything else. But yeah, that guy ended up buying all three of those monitors at the end of the convention. Like, I sold them all to him as I was packing my car up. I think I made like $700 or $800.
Nice.
Yeah, whatever. Enjoy these, I guess.
So, okay, so back to the history, I guess. First release of the console, and this is kind of an interesting point, I think, because it shows there's a sort of a progression with PC Engine. The first release of the console very much feels like a Hudson thing, and the reason is, so it's a very small little unit. It's about the size of maybe two or three CDs. Like three CD cases stacked on top of each other. It's actually, I think it's still considered the smallest console, like, mainstream console ever released. And it's got one controller port on the front, and its cartridge slot is a card. And, I mean, I always called these Hue cards. I guess most people call them Hue cards. I don't know.
Yeah, that's the correct pronunciation.
It seems weird in a way because it's Hudson, so you wonder if it should be, like, Huh card. But
yeah, we actually were one of the commercials or something, like, it's a Japanese presentation. They say Hue cards.
Oh, do they? Like, oh, okay. Well, then there
you go.
Solve
the problem there.
Yeah,
yeah,
really.
There was a forum debate about this once, and we tracked down a Japanese person in a commercial or something saying it. We're like, ah, got it.
So Hue cards are essentially their technology that I guess Hudson created this.
Oh, yeah. They were the B cards on MSX. There was this cartridge.
That's right, MSX.
MSX.
Had it.
Yeah, and then that cartridge, you've put the B card into it, and it had games and stuff on it. But yeah, the B cards are like the precursor. That's why, to me, like MSX and PC Engine sort of go hand in hand sometimes, because I think Hudson's groundwork for what they ended up doing with the PC Engine was came from the MSX, I think, because that's where the B cards were at and all that.
So basically, if you've never seen one of these before, it looks like about 2 credit cards, maybe 2 or 3 credit cards kind of stacked. It's like that size. It's credit card size, but a little bit thicker, okay? And it's plastic, and you've got game art on the top. And then if you look at the bottom, there's like a little black section that's about almost half the size of the whole card. And then there's little pins, little connector pins on that. And basically, that black section is the whole thing. Like underneath that is a very tiny PCB board with all of your, chip and everything on there. And it's just straight, I guess it's a straight EEPROM on a chip. Is there any other, on a normal Hue card, were there ever any sort of add-on stuff built into those?
No, I mean, they've always just been like that plastic thing, and like the black section is the circuit board.
Right.
Everything else is just plastic.
I was just curious if they ever added any like upgraded capabilities or added any sort of extra chips into any of those for standard Hue card releases, or if it was just the
Well,
ROM
no, because
data.
the PC Engine's awesome in the fact that it can address like 2 megs of memory without a mapper. So most of the
Ooh.
Hue cards, you can make a huge friggin' Hue card game. You don't need a mapper. Like, eventually you need one. Like, that's like a Super Street Fighter. Like,
Oh,
that
right.
has like a mapper on it. But like, even that one, like the board's a little bigger, and it has that like bumped up tab, kind of like the arcade card and stuff.
So there were a few games that had a little bit of sort of added components in there, but not much,
Yeah,
I
it was
guess.
mostly just the it was just memory mappers, nothing like where, oh, like, this game has a special sound chip or anything
Right.
like that. It was always just, the ROM chips and like a mapper if needed. And then like the system cards just have like the ROM and RAM
Yeah.
nonsense. Other than that, no, there was never anything. But I think we joked about one time making an FM sound card for the
Hey.
turbo and put I like doing it that way. We joked about it. I think it's possible, but it involves the masochism of hardware stuff for a 30-year-old console, so you have to like really just be that bored
Yeah.
and have that much free time. So we never got around to it. But we did joke about it a few times.
Okay, there's a million variations of this thing, but it starts out with the original, which is just that little cute white thing that fits something that looks like a credit card. And then you've got one controller, and there's a add-on you can get that allows you to plug in more controllers. But a lot of the games, I think, early on were single-player games anyway. Later on, they did get some multiplayer. And it was interesting because they had five-person multiplayer before
Yeah.
anybody else did. Which made
Like,
Bomberman great. Bomberman was pretty much a killer app on the thing because you could play it with
Oh,
way
yeah.
more players than you could on the Famicom, especially.
Yeah, and Bomberman, both the Bomberman 93, 94, those games are
Oh, they're
like,
great.
yeah, like I remember the one CCAG, I had my Bomberman running just to like make sure my stuff was set up. And like before the convention started, like other people setting up their stuff just wandered over and like started playing it. And it was like there was like 4 people just playing my Bomberman. And I'm like, oh, hey, I kind of need to turn that off and put the game in that I made now. Sorry.
We used to have an anime convention where I lived in North Carolina that had this guy who would always come, and there was a game room, and he would always come, and like half of the game room was his stuff, and he would always bring a TurboGrafx-16 or what's called a Turbo Duo, which we'll explain that in a little bit. But I also remember he always used to bring, I guess it was a Sega Saturn Bomberman that had the special connection thing where you could get 16 players, and he would set that up on a big screen and play that, and that was always really cool. And I always thought that was fun, but I always gravitated over towards his Turbo Graphics stuff instead because I thought that was cooler. Okay, so we start out with our base model. This is 1987, and right away, it's a huge improvement over the Famicom because it's got this much, much better graphics chip, which is a 16-bit graphics chip, which comes back to kind of bite them in the butt a bit because the main controller chip is 8-bit, and apparently, you know, in Japan, nobody cared. If it looked good and it played games, that's all they really cared about. But in America, there was this kind of marketing push, that whole console war thing of, you know, we've got the fastest, bestest, blah, 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 and the megaflops and terachips and, you know, whatever the...
Yeah, the idiotic bit wars of the 90s. Yeah.
And so when this thing was finally released in America as the TurboGrafx-16, they made one major change, which was to make the... to just hugeify the console.
Dumb.
Really, really bad decision because, for one thing, it just does not need to be that big. And for another thing, it made their you know, add-on hardware decisions down the road a lot more complex, I think.
Then they had to basically redesign, like, the interface unit. Like,
yeah.
They couldn't just bring the briefcase over. And the thing that drove me nuts, when I was a kid, I had TurboGrafx before I got the CD add-on. The RF port, I didn't have a booster because I was, you know, 10. I just had the RF thing. The RF port is on the left side of the machine, and it, like, sticks out. So, like, you can't, like, neatly stick it like you want to.
Oh, right.
And, like, it wasn't so bad, you know, like, the PC Engine is like that, too, because, you know, the expansion thing is on the back.
Right.
But the PC Engine is tiny.
Yeah.
So, like, it doesn't... Right. The PC Engine, you can, like, turn the thing side, do whatever you want with it, get out of the way. But the TurboGrafx is, like, this big clunky thing for no reason. And I remember when I finally got the CD thing, I was like, oh, finally, all the cords come out the back now. But then the interface unit, it like, makes it so tall, it didn't fit where I wanted to put it on my shelf in my entertainment center as a kid. And I just stared at it, like, so angrily, like, why are you so tall? Like, it fit in, but then you couldn't open the CD drive.
Oh, yeah. That's...
Yeah, what I ended up doing, I would twist the little lock and pull the CD drive out, put the game in, and then put the whole CD drive back in because I couldn't open the lid. And I was like, this is stupid. Why did they do this?
Yeah, it's a really bad decision on their part to change it. And I think the thinking was that in America, everything has to be big and beefy and powerful looking. Which is...
No, that's pretty much it.
Not at all really how it was. I mean, it needed to not look like a kid's toy. And that's true.
Right.
So, okay. So your TurboGrafx-16, it came out and everyone was like... Everyone who bought into it anyway was like, this thing blows everything out of the water. It's the best graphics. Whatever you're playing is garbage. But the big problem was that, you know, NEC and Hudson just didn't really have... I don't think they had built up yet the needed skills to sell in America. I don't think NEC has ever really learned how to sell in America. I think nothing they've ever done has ever translated to America, computers, any of that. But, you know, Hudson was doing a lot of stuff with Nintendo, and Nintendo would kind of sell it for them, and I think that worked for them. But when they were doing it themselves, not so much. So...
Right.
They kind of marketed it as, hey, we've got a 16-bit graphics. It's so great. And then somebody probably, I don't know if it was Nintendo or Sega that first started, like, running ads against them or whatever. But somebody pointed out, hey, look, this thing's got an 8-bit CPU. It's lie. They're lying to you. It's not really 16-bit.
Yeah.
And Americans were so stupid at the time. Like, we as kids were so stupid to believe that. To believe that mattered. All it really does is just slightly slow down, like, some of the technical stuff. It doesn't really change, like, the quality of the video or anything. And I don't think...
Right, and I mean, my favorite argument with that, with all that bit war stuff, with the CPU stuff, is you can't see the CPU bitness. The graphics bitness is what really matters.
Exactly.
And the best way to explain this is... The Intellivision has a 16-bit CPU in it, and that thing is hideous, and it's a horrible game.
Oh, yeah.
It's better than the Atari.
I will argue that it is better than the Atari. But anyway, so the main unit comes out. It comes out in 1987. In America, it comes out in 89, I guess. And at the time, it's competing with the Famicom. And then NEC and Hudson do something that will literally blow away the entire market. They release a CD-ROM. And it's the first time anyone has put a CD-ROM in a console. It makes a huge difference. I think when you look at the PC Engine before the CD-ROM, it's all like most of it is arcade type ports, or it's like little games that are mostly Hudson stuff, or it's like shooters. You know, the kind of stuff you'd see in arcades. It's not the Nintendo experience. You're not playing like, you know, Zelda or there's Newtopia. You're not playing tons of like Final Fantasy and all these kinds of like role playing games, like big actiony games that are kind of built around like a console. It's all kind of arcadey type stuff.
And then the CD thing came out, and we got stuff like Cosmic Fantasy that just kind of blows everything away with all the CD thing let the presentation of RPGs. Like, I think the presentation we became used to, we have a lot to thank the PC Engine CD for, because it allowed for that to happen. Like, the PC 98 and even the MSX, they were doing stuff like that because they had the advantage of discs where they could keep getting data. Like, the PC Engine is the console that brought that idea to consoles, because the Nintendo wasn't fully capable of it. And you'd sometimes get the little cool like screenshots and things happening, but for the most part, like the Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy never really had that like wow factor presentation.
That cinematic experience was never there.
Oh yeah, like the status screens and stuff in Cosmic Fantasy are like worlds ahead of like any Nintendo role playing games presentation. Just like the colors and the giant pictures of the characters and stuff, like that stuff is like pretty groundbreaking.
And I think some of that goes back to the graphics chip, because as far as I remember reading, the sprite sizes, the maximum sprite sizes were also much larger.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They're huge. So you can have much bigger images, and you can use sprites to create, you can use a combination of like background images and sprites to create like huge looking animations that are not actual animations, they're trickery. You know, uses like a sprite for a mouth or sprites for giant eyes that look like they're a part of one image, but they're actually just like little moving parts attached to a background image. But you can create these like huge cinematic experiences, these little cutscenes that really at the time only PCs in Japan could do, because they were the only things that had, you know, high enough resolution graphics to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the sort of the defining lines that I wanted to bring up, is that I think when the console first comes out, it's very much sort of Hudson's arcade thing. And then once the CD-ROM system comes out, you see it shift to, okay, now it's NEC's realm. Because once that CD-ROM comes out, they're now capable of essentially reproducing a lot of their computer games, a lot of the games that are most popular on their computer systems, the PC-88 especially, into a home console, which really revolutionizes a lot of genres. Because, I mean, you look at like in the 90s, especially like the late 90s, everything was FMV was the huge thing, and I think Japan really drove that with their anime games. You know, all these anime FMV cutscenes, but you wouldn't really have any of that had it not been for PC Engine sort of creating the groundwork for that, you know, in an actual graphics engine.
Yeah. And like you said about the creating that environment where like PC 98's games came over to the console world, like there was a ton of them that actually did that, you know, like Emerald Dragon and like Budai and a couple Ease other ones like Lost Lure and stuff. Ease.
Lure. Of course, Ease, yeah.
But all that stuff was able to hit a console finally because of the CD hardware just let you like do what was needed for it to be like the computer that it came from. And like my favorite example is like Emerald Dragon. The PC Engine version of that game is awesome because of it goes back to the color count. Like the high color count of the PC Engine made that game look so like bright right. and vibrant. Another example would be like the PC Engine had like the Dragon Slayer games. We got a really amazing port of like Sorcerian and Legend of Heroes, and we even got some like exclusive ones, like the Xanadu games and stuff. We got all kinds of stuff like that. Where what really sucks though is that stuff didn't make it to America. So like, well, part of it's because by the time those were coming out in Japan, when they would have finally localized them, it's like, okay, it would have been like PlayStation's out, so it's a little too late. But yeah, like there's so many like amazing games hiding on the PC Engine, and like the language barrier made it where the Western world didn't get to like partake of it, because we have like Chrono Trigger was like a big thing in America, and there's games on the PC Engine of that caliber, like that kind of cool factor that we just never got to play.
Yeah. I remember reading that there was people that used to, like, there was a magazine or something that was all, like, PC Engine. And all it did was it just, like, cataloged, like, CD releases in Japan and showed, like, artwork and stuff like that. And you could buy this catalog and then you could, like, try to, like, special order, you know, imported games. And the most popular thing, of course, was Dracula X. Which, by the way, is an incredible feat for that system. But you know, and that's what people had to do, because the large majority of these games were not making it to America, which is really sad, because in almost every case, the PC Engine CD version of a game is better. I mean, some of these games were getting released on Super Nintendo once that came out, and it's still just, the PC Engine version was just better. Okay, this CD-ROM system comes out in, and this still blows my mind, it came out in 1988. 1988. That's 2 years before the Super Nintendo. They have a CD-ROM on a home console 2 years before there's a Super Nintendo.
I know, right?
I mean, it took Mind Nintendo blown. Another, like, 10 years to come out with a CD system. And Sega didn't come out with the Sega CD until, what, 91 or 92? Something like that. They were so far ahead of their time, and that probably ended up hurting them in a little bit, because timing for them in America was not good. Timing for them in Japan was perfect, but in America it was just not good. So this system is really, well, these days it's losing its edge in Japan in terms of like popularity, because now the retro thing is all Nintendo. I think in America it still has sort of gained cult following, where I think now it's more popular in America than it is in Japan, probably.
Yeah, actually, well, it's really funny you mentioned that. When I went to Beep, the first time I went there, I was like, hey, I made a game for the PC Engine. They were like, no, you didn't. And I'm like, no, really, I brought it with me. Like, let me show you. Like,
Did they really say that?
Well, yeah, they like... At first, they thought I meant, like, PC, and they thought I was just, like, misspeaking.
Oh, I see.
I'm like, no, PC Engine. I'm like, seriously, look, I got a copy. And even, like, other people I told, everyone's like, no, you mean PC. You don't mean PC Engine. You're high. I'm like, no, it's PC Engine. They're like, what? And it just shocks them. I'm actually amazed how often I talk to people in Japan that, like, Japanese people that don't really know that PC Engine made it to America as the TurboGrafx. They just don't know. And I'm like, yeah, we had, like, you know, Bravo Man and stuff. Like, we got those games. Like, oh, seriously? I'm like, yeah, like, because they thought, I told them I grew up playing Bonk, and they thought that I, like, had rich parents that imported all this stuff. I'm like, no, it was released in the United States.
You probably did. If you had a TurboGrafx, you still probably had slightly more rich parents than other people did.
No, man, I had a loophole, like a cheat system, kind of, I guess. My grandma worked at Sears. So she got the employee discount, but then there was the other trick of when stuff was put on layaway and people didn't pick it up, it counted as open box return. So she got markdown and employee discounts. Like, when I was about three, she got us a box brand new Sega Genesis that someone never picked up.
Oh.
And, like, at the time, and this was, like, 1991, she paid $100 for a Sega Genesis that was brand new.
Wow.
Like, that's, like, and the TurboGrafx, my aunt, they just gave me theirs because they got older and got married. And they're like, here, we're married, you can have this now. And I'm like, ah, cool. Like, that one I got for free. But the other stuff, yeah, it was the Sears loophole, and that probably explains why Sears is going out of
business. Exactly what I was just going to say. And you wonder why Sears is having some of this trouble now, eh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so, like, because I never thought about it as a kid. I had Nintendo, Game Boy, Game Gear, Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis, wow. Sega CD. My friends, like, how do you have all this stuff? Like, I don't know. My grandma just shows up with it. And it's because she was getting this stuff so cheap because of the way that their store policies worked. And it's like, that's cool. Because like, she was basically getting them at like 60, 70% off or something.
That's and fantastic.
Me and my sister, yeah, it's awesome. But me and my sister were the, like, her only grandkids too. So that played into it where it was like we were the only people she had to funnel presents to or whatever. But that's how a lot of that happened. I guess I was very fortunate because, yeah, looking back, it's like, man, this stuff was expensive.
Yeah. But,
you know, grandma Mega. Had to hook Sears. Yeah.
So, okay, so the CD comes out. It's incredible. And I really think, honestly, for a very, very, very long time, the PC Engine was the system that got me interested in like, sort of the niche side of the Japanese gaming market. Because when I was younger, you know, it was a lot of, like, Super Nintendo is the best thing, you know. Oh, Famicom. Yeah. Oh, it's so cool. Famicom, this system. But PC Engine is, like, how do I say? It's marijuana. Okay. Well, I guess you could say, well, would you even clear it? I guess you could say it's marijuana. It's marijuana or it's ecstasy. It's a gateway drug to the dark dungeon that is what we're in right now, which is, you know, Japanese gaming and PCs and all this kind of stuff. And that's one of the points, though, that's really important to me is that there is a direct link between the PC Engine and the rest of the sort of Japanese PC market. I mean, it's in the name. It's PC Engine. It's taking the PC and putting it into a console. And I think that's why NEC was so eager to jump in with this, because once they saw that graphics chip, they probably thought, and I don't know. I don't know what NEC was thinking at the time, but my theory is that NEC was looking at this graphics chip coming that Hudson was producing, and they're saying, ah, yes. Now we can release our PCs for home markets, for consoles. Because the one thing that NEC had that nobody else had at the time was the ability to display kanji really well. That was like the one big huge setback for all of computers in Japan was freaking kanji. And it's why, you know, Microsoft didn't break into Japan until like the mid-90s because DOS just couldn't do kanji. The resolution was not good enough. And so NEC's thinking, you know, we'd love to make a console. I'm sure we, you know, we've got all these games and we've got all these developers that are making games that are making them for our platform, but we're not really making money off of it. Because I don't think they were making tons of money off of those games at all. I don't, because, you know, anybody can just get a disc, release it on that system. I mean, there's no, like, royalty or anything like that, I guess.
Right.
But when they see this graphics chip, they probably, in my view, thought, hey, this is the chip that will make our, you know, PC-88 into an actual console on the TV that can power this. And so they said, let's make this. Let's turn our PC market into a home market and try and make some money off of it. And I think, in a way, that's one of the other reasons why it didn't click in the U.S., because that market was not, that base idea was not there in the U.S. I mean, Falcom's games were not in the U.S. For the most part. I mean, there was like an EZ1 port to DOS that's not very good.
Oh, man, but I had that. Oh. I remember as a kid playing it, it's a quick tangent, you know, I played it as a kid, and the music on the computer we had it on was just like the DOS beep speaker music. And so it's playing like the East music, like the town theme, but it's just coming out of like the PC speaker, and I'm playing it at like 3 a.m, and there's no volume control.
No. Nope.
It's the PC speaker. And I my dad finally from like the other room was just like, he just stomps into my room and he, you know, there's some swearing involved. And he basically was like, turn that off. What is wrong with you? And I ended up, I opened the computer and I unplugged the PC speaker. Like, yeah, because like the configuration didn't really have any way to like go, I don't want that. So I just unplugged it because it was like just this loud blaring, like beat boot rendition of the East soundtrack.
It is glaring, blaring. That is definitely true. Someone sent me a copy of it and boy, yeah, it is. If there was like a hardware software volume setting, they'd set it to the max because it's it's one of the loudest PC beeper sound games I've ever played somehow. Yeah. I don't know if it's like the pitch or something, frequencies.
I think it's because it's actual music. A lot of other games just had sound effects or like little bleep, like ditties, like jingles occasionally, whereas East is like just blasting out the soundtrack nonstop. Like there's never a pause in sounds. And what the funniest thing about the DOS version of Ease 1 is that Adol looks like a Wookiee, like walking around. Oh, it's so dumb looking. Like he just has this like reddish brown smear with little black dots for eyes. It's like, man, he's a Wookiee.
But you got to consider, okay, so that's America's first sort of major like view of Ease, and then when the Turbo Duo comes out, which I'll explain what that is in just a second, they ship Ease 1 and 2 as a pack-in bundles for it. And so suddenly we go from having that DOS version of Ease, if you were even like in the know to know what Ease was at that time, which very few people were, to this incredible blow-your-mind experience of Ease with these full cutscenes and, you know, this surprisingly good 90s voice actors, you know, opening up saying, you know, Ease, an enchanted paradise, blah, 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 blah. You know, and you're like, what is this? It's just a huge shift. And, you know, CD audio. And for anyone who doesn't really know, because maybe there's some younger than millennials listening to this, I don't know. But, you know, when we're a kid, there's two types of music in the world. At least for us as gamers, there's two types of music in the world. There's CD music, you know, which is like, you know, studio music, cassettes, you know, CDs, whatever. You know, someone in a studio sat down with real instruments and made this. And then there's game music, which is chips. It's bleeps and bloops and it's, you know, FM and it's stuff like that. And then PC Engine has a CD. And they could have gone the route that a lot of other people probably would have gone had they done the CD first, which is to maximize the data on that CD. So they had the huge, huge data track so they could, you know, put the entire of Final Fantasy VII on one CD or something stupid like that, you know, and have chip music. And then maybe, you know, maybe, oh, we'll put in a slightly better FM synthesis chip in the hardware for the CD-ROM system so that we can get a, you know, higher resolution FM, you know, upgraded OPL, whatever, blah, blah, blah. No. They said, we got a great idea. Because this is before, keep in mind, folks, this is before the days of MP3 and, you know, good quality audio compression. You can't take a full studio recording and shrink it down to 4 megabytes. Okay. So it has to be, you know, essentially a digitized, full, uncompressed analog file, which is huge. So what they did was they said, instead of doing chip music, we're going to allow this system to read actual audio tracks from the CD and play it direct through the sound system. So you've got your game, and your game data track is maybe like 100, 130 megabytes. And then a large, in most cases, a lot of the rest of the game is audio tracks. And it's actual CD audio tracks. And that meant that they could sit down in a studio and record audio with real guitars and everything and real instruments and play that in their game. Or they could sit down with actors and record actual voice acting and put that in their game, and it just plays through as CD audio, which is a brilliant workaround, you know, with the technology at the time. And it also meant that most PC Engine games, you can stick them in your CD player and skip the data track and listen to the music. Woohoo!
Yeah.
If you still have a CD player in the year 2019. But that's a huge shift, because suddenly, you know, you look at your Ease and you're going from boop, beep, 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 boop, beep, 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 you know, to a full-on Ryo Yonemitsu, you know, in the studio jam session. And it's incredible. And, of course, you know, some of the people, some of the companies cheaped out and just used MIDI or just had, like, some really, you know, half-ass band going, you know, here's a keyboard, beep, 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 you know, in their games. But the studios that did it right blew you out of the water. Like Konami. Sat there with a freaking Roland Soundspace three-dimensional system making music that's, while still technically MIDI, is like the highest end possible you can do. Just making your ears explode with like music awesomeness. But then, of course, we didn't get that game in the U.S.
Yeah, bad idea there.
Yeah, that would have sold the console. I mean, at that time period, had it come out, that probably would have just sold the console straight up.
Oh, totally. Because Castlevania 4, like Super Castlevania on Super Nintendo, was like a system seller. It was like that and Contra 3 were like big selling points when I was a kid, for why all my friends and stuff wanted one.
But, yeah.
You know, to your point about CD audio, though, there is a divide on the PC Engine CD where some games you can tell like how badly they cheaped out on the audio. Yeah, some just sound like, you know, a Yamaha like piano, like the toy piano, where they hit like the demonstration button and recorded whatever song came out. And it's such a world of difference.
It's when you so true. Ones where,
you know, you can still tell some of them, you know, they're using the, like you said, like the like MIDI sound modules, where technically like some dude composed the song and it's all in some software program that's just barfed out to these MIDI modules. But like,
yeah,
there is a huge difference between, you know, the department store Yamaha with MIDI and like routing it out to like five different synthesizers and Roland modules and stuff.
Yeah.
Where it's like, it's still not a real band, but sometimes it's like, man, this is close enough. And that's like the big difference. And it's sort of like, what always drove me nuts as a kid was we had an Amiga. Like the Amiga 500. And any game that tried to do guitar made me want to just smash the computer, because it was like sampled guitars that just sound horrible. And thankfully, the PC Engine, all the guitar tracks in those games, even if it's like not a real human playing it, like the like digital sound module guitar sounded good. But then we got Lords of Thunder.
That's what I was going to say. But there's Lords of Thunder. Tease Music is the name of the whatever.
Yeah, and then we got, well, like that, or like Gate of Thunder.
Yeah,
like all
which
those
I think
games.
I think Gate of Thunder's music is actually better than Lords of Thunder's music, because it's not as over the top. It's more of a groove. Lords of Thunder is literally it's like Ted Nugent on acid. I mean, it's
like at times Lords of Thunder's music does not fit the game, but it's so awesome.
No.
And we got other ones like, you know, Sapphire on arcade, the arcade CD shooter. Like, that's just like straight up power metal. Even East 3 had like guitar stuff. And it's like hearing that, where it's like real guitar solos instead of like those toy sampled guitars that just sound horrible, was like, it just was like a huge game changer, because the Amiga was supposed to be like the end all be all for computers and games and stuff. And it's like, nah, man, listen to this TurboGrafx CD. There's like actual guitar sounds coming out of this thing.
And it's just like a small little console, too. It's like, it's the kind of thing that most computer users would have just laughed at. You're like, oh, it's look at this little tiny box. Well, what can it do? And you're like, well, listen to this. And so I think that's the advantage. The advantage that later consoles have is that they have, you know, compression. Or when you look at, like, the Super Nintendo later on, I mean, the Super Nintendo is not even close to CD quality, but the ability to put in sort of, like, this sort of hybrid sample system with, like, almost like a MIDI on a DAC kind of weird thing that they had for Super Nintendo actually helped them out quite a bit, because they were able to put more music. Maybe not necessarily better music, but more music and more types of music than other consoles. And I think as you see, like, the PC Engine, like, the time period go on, you see that the PC Engine, while having the best quality sound, doesn't always have enough sound to match the game itself. Like, you look at Dracula X, right? And, like, Dracula X is awesome, but then there's, like, there's little sections, like the room right before the bosses, where they're like, you know, we don't have a whole lot of room left for music, so instead of putting a special small CD track on this room, let's just drop it down to the internal PSG chip, the actual internal sound chip of the original TurboGrafx, and pull the audio from there to play the music for this one room before the boss battle. And so you've got this huge dissonance between, you know, hard rocking CD sound, and, you know, suddenly you get to the, you know, and you're like, really, what? Really, what? And so sometimes they had to do that because they just didn't have enough space. That, and I think looping was kind of a problem, because when you're doing CD music, you know, it's linear. That laser has to actually advance forward to read that song. And then when it gets to the end, it has to go back. And I think, like, they did a pretty good job of, like, making, like, tricking that system the way they did it. But when you've got, like, a song that's, like, 4 seconds long, you know, you've got laser has to seek to that point, read that, and then start over again every time it loops, and that's just not really feasible with a CD, I think.
Yeah, and the other thing is, like, the thing you have to remember too is, like you said, since the thing has to, like, seek the data, it's playing in real time, is while CD audio is playing, if you need to load new data, you can't.
Yeah,
the
that's true.
The song has to stop. Yeah, like, you can't just, like, oh, hey, hang on, I need to, like, load data in tandem with playing this music. Like, that's not a thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not perfect system. It's much better than everything else that was on the market at the time.
Oh, yeah, totally.
So, okay, look, so console variations. Okay, so you've got your original, and then you've got, there's, like, three different models of the original PC Engine, like, the little base unit. There's, like, the, what was it called? The Core Graphx, and then there's, like, the Core Graphx 2 or something like that. There's, like, a gray one.
Yeah, you got the white one, and then you got the gray one, and then you got the other gray one with
orange, like,
on. Yeah,
like, gray with orange letters and gray with, like, purple letters or something like that.
Yeah, well, gray with blue is, like, the
blue,
Core
that's
Graphx,
right.
And the Core Graphx 2 is the orange one, and the base one is the white one.
And I guess the main difference with those is, like, the video, because, like, the original one, the white one, is just pure RF. And then I guess you can get, like, that little, there's, like, a little unit that you can add on to give you the booster or whatever.
Yeah, the AV booster. They're all the models are RF only, I thought.
No, the Core Graphx added in the DIN, the bigger DIN with the AV.
Oh, that's right.
AV.
I always forget they added the DIN, because by the time I ever owned any of those, I was shoving them into the briefcase unit.
Yeah.
And never paid attention. That's right. Yeah, they had the DIN, because, like, the Super Graphics has a DIN too.
They kind of screwed that one up, because they released this thing called the Super Graphics, and it's a really odd looking machine, and it's essentially compatible with it's compatible with all of your PC Engine games, but it also has the ability to have Super Graphics games, which, you know, take advantage of the enhancements.
All five of them.
Yeah, right? But then, like, I guess it was too expensive, and the shape ultimately screwed them over because they couldn't connect the CD-ROM unit to it.
Oh, that whole thing. I had a Super Graphics. And you have to buy this stupid thing called the RAU-30. It's like the RAU-30, I guess. It's this big, dumb thing that clicks on the back of the Super Graphics, has this big, thick cable that's, like, it's almost like the diameter of, like, a nickel or, like, a quarter. Like, it's like a 5 yen piece, depending where you're at. Like, it's not thin. And then it has this big, dangly plastic square. It looks like a PC Engine. And it just jams into the briefcase unit. It's just this big, stupid extension doodad. And it's so hideous and cumbersome. And that's how you hook the Super Graphics up to the briefcase unit. Or you buy the Super CD-ROM add-on, which makes it look like a vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, really. I was going to say, it really does look like a vacuum cleaner. It's hilarious. There's a picture of it on Wikipedia. If you want to see it, Go look at the PC Engine Super Graphics and then scroll down. You'll see Super Graphics with Super CD-ROM. And it's like, it does. It looks like a vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, that Super Graphics thing, man. I sold all that because I got so
tired of it.
When you have it all, oh no, the games aren't that great. Like, but when you have it all hooked up, the way the cords are all sticking off of it, it doesn't like sit properly. Like the cords are fighting each other, so it like pushes the system apart, basically. Because the way like the you basically have to put the briefcase unit behind the Super Graphics, and then just like stick the Super Graphics out in front. So then like, you know, the footprint of it is massive. But like I stuck them next to each other, and then the way the cord kinks, it like physically makes the console move around, and it's like all this to do what? Like play? There's like
you can play Ghouls and Ghosts or Ghosts and Goblins.
I hate that game. So I don't
like it either.
I was glad to sell all that. The only thing I missed was like Aldines or Aldinus, however any.
Oh yeah.
I don't even know how to pronounce it. I think it's Aldines. I don't know.
But you can emulate that. Just emulate it.
And really, I didn't like the game. I just liked the music, so I just listened to the music at this point. None of it, like, the Super Graphics was a bad idea.
Yeah, it was. And then another sort of bad idea, you've got the Turbo Express, which is a Game Boy? It's like a Game Gear, sort of? It's basically... Yeah. It's a Turbo Graphics system. It's a handheld, and it's got a small LCD, color LCD, and then you can put those Hue card games in the back of it.
And that was the perk to it is that you didn't have to buy new games. It uses the games you already own, which was, you know, way better than a Game Boy or a Game Gear because those you had to buy brand new games.
True.
So there was one smart move there, but you know. It's a product of the time where the color screen isn't that great.
No.
Dead pixels were common.
Capacitors are a big problem nowadays.
Oh, yeah. And then the shooters, some of them, like, because of the screen resolution and stuff, it was, like, hard to play because, like, the bullets just aren't really there sometimes.
Yeah.
And dead pixels were common. And then the other worst part was, like, the batteries. You get, you turn the thing on, you press a couple buttons, and then the batteries are dead. But I think overall, if you look at all the handhelds from that era, I do think the Turbo Express was the best one, even though the Game Boy won somehow. The Turbo Express, on paper, is just the best one because you don't have to buy new games. It's in color. It's backlit. Like, Nintendo didn't get on the backlighting for, like, a decade later. It took them to finally
That never stopped me as a kid. Like, I think that's one of the things, like, the one thing we always forget is that as kids in that era, I was much more willing to forgive that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, nowadays it's kind of like, I'll take my Game Boy outside if I'm like on the train or something during the day. But it's like, you know, it's not kind of hard to see and that kind of thing. But like when you're a kid, you're just kind of like, this is what we have. So we're going to play it and it's going to be great. And for the Turbo Express, like, okay, yeah, if you can get the games, it's awesome, but you can't get them. I mean, I couldn't anyway. It's like, I don't know where you grew up, but I grew up in North Carolina. And the thing is, okay, the CD-ROM system was only sold in, like, 12 cities in America. So, like, if you weren't close enough to New York City, you couldn't get it. I mean, you could. I think there was, like, eventually they came up with some sort of, like, mail order system or something like that. But for a while, at least, you had to be in one of their sort of test markets to be able to get the systems and the games. And that made a big difference because nobody... I mean, there was like one person that I knew in my area that had a TurboGrafx-16. So where are you going to get these games, you know? Where are you going to get the system and all that kind of stuff? Like, it wasn't... Like, on paper, you're right. It's so much cooler and better. But then when you translate that to the real-world application, it's not quite... There.
Where we grew up, like in Cleveland, Ohio. It's really shocking, actually. Like, in the PC Engine community, like online, we were like, crap. Like, a bunch of us all live in the general Cleveland area, or some of them did and moved. And it's like, there was a ton of people from like Cleveland and stuff. And it's like, well, that's weird. But like, at the time, way back then, Toys R Us here had a full It had everything. Like, it anything TurboGrafx related that came out in America, Toys R Us had it right by my house. Like, it was just there. So I guess my area was one of the areas that it was, like, pretty popular. Because, like, for the most part, all the gamers here that are older, they know what it is and remember it and stuff. Like, my friends, like, growing up, they were confused by it because they didn't know. But the people that were a little older than us, because, like, you know, I was born in 88. The people that were, like, basically my aunt and uncle's age, you know, they grew up in the 80s. So they were, like late teens, early 20s in the 90s. They all, that whole era, like, generation of people knew about it in, like, where I live. But, like, my generation, I was the person in my school telling everyone what it was and showing people it. Because when I described it to them, they're like, what are you talking about? So I was telling them about, I think at the time, what game was I playing? I was playing Kadash.
Yeah.
And my friends were like, what are you playing? Like, because we would just sit and talk about what we're playing at the lunch table. I'm like, oh, I'm playing Kadash. And they're like, what? Like, yeah. I'm trying to explain to these people it's Kadash for the TurboGrafx. They're like, the Turbo what? And then, like, no one, they thought I was making up stuff. I brought game cards in to show them because they didn't believe me. And then, like, my friends, the people came over to my house and it became like a freak show sort of thing where kids I didn't really talk to were, like, riding their bike over to my house and knocking on the door going, can we see that thing? And I'd have to, like, show them the TurboGrafx because they had no clue what it was. And they're like, then they'd go back to school and be like, oh, he's not lying. It's this weird machine with these games on it. And at the time, the one I got from my aunt, one of our friends, well, their friends, it's my friend too now. He took the thing and he painted it maroon for what? Some reason.
The main console unit?
Yeah. And I thought that was what it looked like. I didn't know that it was supposed to be black. And then when I saw that they were black, I thought, oh, I must have a special edition one. So that's what I was telling people. Because I didn't know that my aunt's friend just took it and painted it maroon for some reason. Because it looked professionally painted because he's an art guy. He just thought it would look cool to be maroon. And I thought that was normal. And I'm like, oh, I'm dumb. But me, you know, I'm like, oh, so you can just paint consoles. That's cool. I taped off the ports and the like TurboGrafx decal. I sprayed that stupid thing chrome in my garage. I basically blasted chrome paint across the side right up through where the RF jack is. And this, like, chrome paint just went into that port and, like, inside of there. And then, like, the flakes probably did something because there's, like, particles and dust. It shorted the system out after playing it for a bit. Like, it blew a fuse and then some other stuff. But the happy ending to that is we gutted that one because it broke.
Mm-hmm.
We gutted the connector and stuff. And that's what we used when we made Atlantean and stuff. The Hue card thing we use to burn the ROMs for the game when it's ready to be, like, sold is the connector from the one that I spray-painted chrome and murdered. So, the happy ending is we were able to repurpose it to, you know, burn the Hue cards that we were making. So,
wow.
Yeah. But yeah, don't spray your stuff chrome. That flaky chrome stuff is metallic and not good to put inside a machine.
Good to know. So, the moral of the story is don't paint your systems unless you know what you're doing.
Right, yeah, don't be dumb. Yeah, metallic paint's bad.
Metallic's paint is bad, folks. So we've got the core graphics and then the super graphics and then the CD-ROM. And that comes out initially, at least in Japan, as what's lovingly called the briefcase. So you got three main components here. You've got your core graphics, which is the little standard PC Engine box. And then you've got your CD-ROM unit, which is about the same size as like a portable CD player would have been. And it's about the same thickness as the actual PC Engine. And that sits beside it. And then you've got this thing called the interface unit, which is a big plastic shell with like a PCB board in the back to add on like memory for saving, and also like added like a graphics output, and also, you know, the connections to connect the core unit with the CD-ROM system. And so you jam the core unit into that interface unit, and you jam the CD-ROM system into that, and then you've got this cool plastic cover that you can put over top of it, and it's got a handle on it, so it's like a briefcase. You can walk around with it and carry it to your friend's house if you want to. And then, of course, in America, it's completely different. It looks like a Sega CD that someone like just rammed onto the back of a Turbo Graphics unit.
It is a very clunky,
yeah,
bad looking thing.
but one of the nice features is that it aside from having the CD-ROM system, which is a huge upgrade in itself, it adds two things that are really nice. It adds a better video output, especially if you've got the original model where it's only got RF. You get composite, and you get some save RAM. And that was one of the things that I think was a bit... I don't know why they didn't introduce that. I guess they just couldn't really make it work with the original console. But the original console has no save RAM, and so you can't save games other than like if you have passwords and stuff. And maybe that's one of the reasons why it was so arcadey to begin with, because you really kind of need to be able to save for a lot of the games that would come out later. Yeah. So there's this add-on that came out called the Tenokoe Bank, which is like Voice of Heaven or something like that. I don't know the exact kanji. It's something. It's heaven something. I don't know if it's heaven's voice or if it's a different koe.
It's got the voice kanji in it. We call it the Tenoko thing because that's what it looks like to, you know, Western people. But yeah. Tenokoe.
So, and it's basically just some save RAM. So the idea was that your original system doesn't have any save RAM data. Okay, so you can't save your game. But some of the games, they knew that was going to be a problem, so they designed some of the games with the ability to save to that if you have an upgrade. They called it the file cabinet, and then if not, you could use passwords. And passwords are really annoying when you're playing, like, Newtopia, because you don't want to stick in those huge, long passwords. So you attach this device to the back, and it adds some save chips to your system. But then you've got the problem of... You know, your saves aren't saving onto the cartridge. They're saving into a bank. And so your bank's eventually going to fill up because you're playing so many games. The more games you get, the more its problem it is. With a Nintendo or a Super Nintendo, your save data is built into the cartridge. So if you've got 200 cartridges, you've got 200 save data. If you've got one cartridge, you've got one thing of save data. In PC Engine, you've got this bank that's built into the system, kind of like a memory card on PS1, right? So you're limited by that. If you've got 200 games, you got to fit all those 200 games save data into that one little thing, and you can't. So you either got to delete something, or you got to find some other way around that. And what they did was they released these Tenokoe Bank cards, and you could have your little base add-on thing that's got its RAM, and then you can put this card in the Hue card slot, and it will load up this memory manager that will allow you to back up your save data completely, the whole bank. You can't, you know, pick and choose which games, unfortunately. Onto this card, and the card could take three banks at once. And fortunately, they're very cheap nowadays in Japan, so you can get them for like 500 yen or something like that. That's a cool way to like back up your data, because there are some games, and this is the really annoying thing, there are some games like the Shin Megami Tensei CD-ROM port that literally takes up the entire save bank for that game, and you can't load the game unless you have the room free. Like, the game will not even run without it. So you have to... I don't know if it uses it as extra RAM for the game or something, but it will not let you run the game without having the entire save bank empty. So you have to, like, back up all of your data, clear out the whole bank, and then play that game. And that's the only way to play that game.
Yeah, it just reminds me. I checked. Yeah, the 2 is the Clickiani thing. The cards are the version 1. I never used either of them, but the thing about the 2, I guess, would be the one that's the clicky thing on the back. A lot of people have been buying those lately for the save data perk, but also you can RGB mod them.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one people... I know people use them for that, but yeah, I guess it's the two. But yeah, I don't use either of them. I have some of the cards sitting in a stack. I just don't touch them. But I this reminds me of when we were testing development stuff. I'm an idiot, and our backup RAM code we were doing wasn't quite right, and I put it in my dual R and blew out all my Cosmic Fantasy saves. Whoops.
Oh. Oh no.
Something I did, and that code did not work right. And I was like, ah, oh, geez, there went my save. Yeah.
Oh dear.
So I guess had I actually used those,
Yeah, you had those cards, you
know,
could have backed it
yeah,
up.
I could have saved. Yeah, I just people hand those to me because people, it's common I've noticed at conventions here. People have the cards, they think it's a game, they put it in and go, this isn't a game, I don't know what it is, and they just don't want it.
Ah.
Like I've had people just hand them to me, and I'm like, I don't want this either. Like I want to say I have like five of them sitting. Two of them are in cases, the other ones are just loose ones. I'm like,
yeah,
I don't
yeah.
want.
Well, send them to me. I'll use them.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I wonder if they even work still. Like that's the other
they
thing
do.
That's
I'm sure they do. I don't think I've ever seen one of those not work.
Well, that's good because I've had Pokemon and stuff with a stupid battery.
Oh well,
stop.
Yeah, that's true. They're but I think these were. I don't know what kind of memory they used in them, but as far as I know, they don't have to have any sort of battery to keep them alive.
Yeah.
Which is probably why they were more expensive at the time.
Oh yeah. Now they're worthless. Like people sell them for like $2, but.
Okay, so after that, they say, okay, this briefcase thing is kind of cool, but what if people want, you know, they want to buy a new console, and, you know, maybe they don't want to go and, like, buy the main console and then buy this add-on unit and buy this little stuff. Let's put it all in one, which is a smart thing to do. So they released the PC Engine Duo, and the Duo looks really cool. The shape and design of the console looks so late 90s, early 2000s. And it comes out in like 1991, and it almost looks like a PlayStation 2 or something, or even kind of like the PlayStation 3 in the way it's shaped. It's got like that sort of curved look to the. It's not like completely boxy square. It's the top is kind of curved upward, and it's black, and it's got this little like purple slider on it, and flip up things, you know, and it just looks really smooth and sleek.
Yeah,
and of course they are infamous for. Wearing out. The important thing to note is that in the 90s, from like 90 to 94, 95, there was this company in Hong Kong that started releasing these capacitors at a much, much lower price than everybody else on the market was selling stuff at. And NEC was one of the companies that decided to use this company's capacitors. And as anyone who knows anything about computers will tell you, this company's capacitors are infamous for leaking. Not only do they lose their capacitance, I don't know, like the chemical starts to break down and lose its ability to mess with the charge or whatever it does, but they also leak. And then that chemical comes out, and because it's a slightly corrosive chemical, it can even eat away at the metal contacts on the board, which is fantastic for your video games, let me tell you. So the Duos are famous for having these capacitors, and what they do is usually the first sign is either the CD will start loading weirdly, like it'll take longer to load, or it'll act odd, or sometimes it'll say, oh, I'm not reading the disc, or sound will cut out, and this is the big one that usually happens. Sound just starts to kind of, you'll be playing it and it'll just, you'll be like, and then it'll just kind of fizzle out, and then maybe it'll fizzle back in, and maybe it'll fizzle back out, and those capacitors go bad. And it causes a huge problem. And a lot of Duo consoles have to be replaced. They have to be recapped. Where someone who's, you know, better at electronic stuff than me opens it up and takes all of those capacitors and desolders them and puts in new ones. And fortunately, you can do that. And for the most part, it will revitalize your system. But it's expensive and a real major pain in the butt. So then after that, NEC releases the Duo R.
There's the RX was the last
RX.
One.
RX, okay, yeah. And they, to me, actually look... They actually look a bit not as cool as the Duo to me. They're, like, they're white.
Yeah, they're, like, little white, little, like, UFO-domed-looking things.
You know, they remind me of those Microsoft ergonomic keyboards that they came out with in the mid-90s.
Right, yeah, they're ugly. Like, they have no... They're too sleek, like, to the point where they don't look like anything. Like, the Duo, the plain Duo, one of my favorite things about it it was like the stupid color scheme they picked, where it's black, because then it has like the blue highlights, like slightly in certain spots, kind of like the IBM and Dell did that in the 90s with like their ThinkPads or like their platform PCs. Like they were jet black, but they had like that little blue button in the corner. Everything else was just black. Like the Duo did that thing with the funny plastic design where it had like a little like 90s wobbly things just because.
Oh yeah, the little like grooves and stuff. And
yeah, it's like, hey, we made it look kind of jazzed up for no reason.
Yeah.
And then the Duo R and RX were the exact opposite, where it's like, this thing's just round.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, all right, thanks. Like,
it's a little
like,
too sleek.
Yeah, I had an R and it was like super reliable and great, but it's like, man, this thing's ugly. It's just a plain white thing. There's no distinguishing features. It's just this white half dome with a cool little like CD LED thing in the front. And the thing.
Yeah, and it's got those like there's like some like dividing lines in it that are very oddly placed. It looks like it's sectionalized for no reason.
Yeah, what's really funny about it too is like, and this is like an ongoing theme with all the machines, they don't have a power light. Like people mod them now to add power LEDs. I'm so dumb. My Duo R power brick died, and I went and I bought a new one at Radio Shack, and I'm stupid. And when I came home, I didn't. I had to take the Duo R with me to Radio Shack because they had those stupid the adapter plugs. I had to figure out which fit. So I get it all. I go home. I plug it in, and I'm stupid. And for some reason, in all this like spazzing out about getting my Duo to work again, I plugged everything in and nothing happened. Like nothing lit up. And I'm like, oh great, it's the Duo is actually dead. And it's like, I didn't plug it into the TV. I just plugged it into the wall. There's no power LED.
No power. There's no way to know if it's on.
Yeah, but if I would have pushed the run button, the CD would have started to load. And then the CD LED lights up because it starts to read stuff. But other than that, the thing has no indication that it's on. And they toy with you. Like the power switches on all the consoles, when you slide it to on, it's just like an orange sticker. It's like, I guess that means it's power because I can see an orange sticker. Neat.
You know which position it's in.
Yeah, so like people actually mod power LEDs into these things. Like they put cool blue lights and stuff in them because you have no way to know the thing's getting power.
That's smart, actually. I wish I had that. But I don't have a Duo anymore. I used to have two Duos and a briefcase. And then I also had a Duo in America that had bath capacitors, and I eventually sold that off. But then what I did was I bought a modded briefcase that had RGB output on it, which turns out it's not a very good mod. It wasn't a very well done mod, but I didn't know that because I bought it on Yahoo Auctions.
You were saying it was a hot glue special, basically.
Yeah, it seems like it. I've still not gotten the interface unit completely apart to even see. It seems to be so hot glued that it's like you can't even get the thing apart that easily. I don't want to break it, but but when I bought that, I then turned around and sold my Duos and my other briefcase to try and make some money back. And I was also just downsizing a lot of stuff anyway. So I'm now down to a briefcase model, and I think to me, the briefcase model is the most 90s. It's the most sort of PC engineiest of the PC engines.
It's the one I kept. Like I sold my Duo R's. I had two of them. I sold those and just kept the briefcase because of the stupid 90s aesthetics of it.
Yeah. The cool thing too is that the briefcase has this like little clip that you like pull up and it like forcibly ejects the units out.
Yeah. Yeah, the eject button, yeah. Which it's comical.
It really is.
You don't need it, but it's there.
But one of the things that's really cool about the briefcase is that the CD-ROM unit is detachable. It does come out from the briefcase. And going back to what I was talking about of like NEC, they actually designed a unit. They actually designed a PC-88 model computer system that had a special notch in the top of the unit that had a connector for that CD-ROM. So this particular one is the most expensive model you can get of PC-88 computer systems, because you can take that CD-ROM from the PC engine out and set it down into the top of this computer case for this PC-88 system, and it will read the CD as a CD-ROM. And there were, like, a handful of games for PC-88 that were designed to run on that CD system. And so the PC Engine is this sort of logical progression the NEC has from their PC systems, but then it's also the reverse is true, because that PC Engine then goes back and adds new capabilities to the PC-88. And so you can really see that NEC was trying to, like, milk this idea of, like, hey, let's promote us and our platform through this thing with yeah. Hudson. But it helped a lot of companies, because there were a lot of companies that were mainly computer companies like Falcom and others and Microcabin and stuff like that, who their market share was always going to be niche. Because once consoles took off in Japan, that became the market. And they were always going to be a niche market because computers were just too expensive for the average person. I mean, in Japan, even today, there's this sort of ingrained thing that you don't get a computer until you get to college. In my high school now, we have like 750 students, and there's like, as far as I know, there's like three of them who own their own computer. They have smartphones, but they don't own a computer. You don't own a computer until you're in college. And it was because at that time, I think they were very, very expensive, and schools weren't really integrating them and stuff like that. And they didn't really have like really big expensive computer labs until a little bit later on. So nobody has a computer until you're in college. And who's buying games? Well, you know, at first it was all salarymen because they were the only people that had computers. But once the Famicom comes out, suddenly it's kids are buying all the games. And so how do we market all this stuff that we've got to kids? And for these companies like Falcom and Microcabin and even Hudson to some extent, the PC Engine was the way to do that. Suddenly they could take all of these games that they've been making for PC and make them into console experiences that kids could buy and play. And what that meant was is that in some cases, quite a few cases actually, the PC Engine games were not quite as kid-friendly as the Famicom counterparts would be. There was quite a lot of less than safe for work, we'll say, games that were released for the PC Engine. Some of them unofficially.
Yeah.
But that was the other thing, too, is like, to a certain extent, once the CD came out, like, if you happened to have enough money to own a CD burner, you could make your own game or you could copy games. Because there's, in 1988, copy protection for a CD-ROM was it cost too much to buy a CD burner. That was copy
exactly,
protection.
Exactly, yeah. Like, no one has that thing.
Like, a CD burner at that time was something like $3,000. Like, they existed, but you couldn't afford it. And so that was all the copy protection they needed, and it worked. But what that means is for us as, you know, retro players now is you can burn these games. I mean, you can take them, put them on CDs and play it.
They don't have region protection either.
Yeah. Now, the Hue cards did. They had a region protection where they just, like...
flipped the bits.
Yeah.
The pins are just inverted. It's so stupid.
It didn't, but one of them has, like, an extra layer of protection, too, I believe, right? Like, an extra, like, a chip that will lock out other... Like, I think the Japanese one has both a pin and an actual chip that will lock out regions, I think it is.
Yeah, doing the... I don't know the full specifics, but doing a region mod on a Japanese system to play American cards, I think it involves some extra work. Whereas the TurboGrafx, you literally just have a bunch of the pins on the Hue card connector just reversed in order, and then that's it. But yeah, there's something I don't remember because I don't do a lot of the mod work stuff. But yeah, something else has to be done to bypass some other nonsense, if I remember right. But most people.
Well, but very few people in Japan care about playing English games anyway.
Yeah, and people that get Turbo or like Dual Rs, it's like, oh, I can't play US games, whatever. Like they weren't planning on playing those anyway.
Yeah, play it on Wii. To me, the Wii is like the best emulator ever, and there's a lot of good PC Engine stuff on the Wii. And actually, the Wii is actually how I really got into PC Engine at first, because Castlevania was the thing that got me to really, really, really want to play PC Engine. I remember a fun story. Ease was a series that I knew nothing about as a kid. I grew up in the sort of the era of Nintendo and Super Nintendo, and you know, in my area, they were king. Sega was something that very few people had, and if you did, well, nobody really cared, because other than Sonic, nobody cared about Sega games in my area. It was all Nintendo. And so PC Engine was just, I mean, nobody had TurboGrafx. But there was that guy that I mentioned that would, remember the guy I mentioned that would go around to conventions and stuff? Mm-hmm. When he was a bit younger, he worked at a video game store locally that was kind of like one of those stores that used to pop up back in the day that would sell, like, import video games and anime, like, you know, VHS tapes or, like, bootlegs from China or whatever. You know, just like a mishmash of, like, Japanese culture stores, and they would usually market themselves as a game store, but realistically they were more like a Japanese store. And mm-hmm. he used to work at that store, and I would go in there and he would tell me about different games and stuff that I'd never heard of, and be like, oh, you know, if you're really into gaming, you should try out this and you should try out that. And like, I remember I bought my Japanese copy of Final Fantasy V there, you know, long before it ever got released in the US or anything like that. But this guy, one day, he's like, this is like 2000, I guess, or 2001, I don't know. He's like, hey, so I've got this game, it's for the TurboGrafx-16. And he's like, you know, we got an extra copy of it in or something like that. I don't remember what the deal was. And he's like, you should try this game out. And I was like, oh, okay. He's like, it's really, really famous, it's really, really cool. And I'm like, okay. So he's like, you know, we've got an extra copy of this, I'll give it to you. Or, I don't know, maybe he's like, I'll sell it to you for $10 or something really, you know, really cheap like that or something. I don't know. But he gave it to me, and it's on a CD-ROM. He's like, you know, I'm like, I don't have this system. And he's like, you can. There's an emulator you can get. You can play it on that emulator. Just go on your computer. And I was like, okay. Well, it's Ease 1 and 2.
Nice.
And I hadn't played an Ease game at that point. You know, when I was younger, you would see, like, you'd get, like, these ROM packs or stuff that you would download, and they would always, or you'd go to, like, a ROM website, and you would always see, like, Ease 3. You know, Wanderers from Ease, and be like, well, what's that? What's this Wise game, or, you know, whatever. And mm-hmm. I would, like, see it, but then I would never really play it. Or I would try and play it and be like, what's going on? I'm confused. But I never could, like, grasp the concept of Ease at that time. So he gives me this Ease 1 and 2 for the PC Engine, which is now, like, a really valuable rare game. And I remember taking it home and putting it in that emulator. I remember playing it. I'm like, I don't get this. He told me, he was like, you know, you got to bump into enemies and like you do it like sideways and stuff. I'm like, okay. Like, this wants to be Zelda, but it's not. And I'm like, I just didn't get it. Like, I remember going outside of the Manea town and just being like really confused as what to do. And, yeah. And maybe I didn't have armor and stuff and equipment on, so probably couldn't even damage the enemies or something. I don't know. And I was like, the music sounds all right. I don't know. This isn't exactly the hype that he said it was. And so I took it back. And I went back and I was like, yeah, I'm not getting this. He's like, really? And I'm like, yeah, the artwork and stuff's cool. The pictures on the back are really cool. But I don't really think I understand this game. He was just going to go, really? And I was like, yeah, you can take it. And so either I sold it back to him or gave it back to him or whatever. And I remember he was just really confused. And then I saw him several years later. After this point, I had, like, figured out the Ease series. Because it wasn't until I sat down with Oath and Felghana that I really started to, like, figure out how the series worked and what it was about. And then, yeah. Like, I went back and started playing, like, that kind of stuff. But the other thing that happened was that... So I started playing Oath and Felghana, and two things happened. One was, when the Wii came out, they said, we're going to start doing TurboGrafx-16 stuff. And I was like, yay! So they release Dracula X on the Wii. And then after that, they release Ease 1 and 2 on the Wii. And everybody says, if you want to play Ease, if you want to understand Ease 1 and 2, you need to play it on the TurboGrafx-16. And now that it's on the Wii, that's your best bet. So I'm like, okay, I'll give this another try. And having understood better the series, I gave it another try and I loved it. I think maybe I even played, like, the Ease Eternal first before playing on the PC Engine, which I think it's weird with, like, Ease 1 and 2. You need to, like, I think you need to start newer and then go back to old instead of starting old and going forward. Like, you need to play the progression in reverse to have appreciation for the old bump system. But anyway, the Wii is what got me interested in TurboGrafx-16 and PC Engine, because I saw these games on the Wii on the Virtual Console and was like, I need to play more of this. Like, I remember for Christmas or something one year, like, my parents were at this point where they were like, you know, you're 19 and we don't care, so we're not gonna, like, do anything cool for Christmas or something, so, like, here's, like, $30. Have fun. So I remember, like, what I did was I went online to whatever it was called at the time. Now it's Nintendo Life. It used to be, like, Virtual Console something .uk or something like that. And so they had this big database, and I would go onto their database and look up all the games that were, like, games that I had not heard of that they recommended I should play. And I just bought a whole bunch of these with the Nintendo points, and most of them ended up being TurboGrafx games. So I got, like, Ys 1 and 2, I got Newtopia 1 and 2, I got Dragon's Curse, I guess it is, and some other stuff. I was like, this system is really cool. So then I found out that I was going to go to Japan, and I was like, okay, so immediately, well, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to buy a PC Engine. And literally, that was the very first thing that I did when I got to Japan. I had one day stay in Tokyo. I was going to be studying in Fukuoka, which is, if you know anything about Japanese geography, it's like way on the other side.
Nowhere near the cool stuff.
Well, you say that, but actually, I think Fukuoka is cooler. But anyway.
Oh, yeah, there's cool stuff, but you're not near, like, the Osaka and Tokyo, like, mega gaming hubs and stuff. You're, like, way, like, 6 hours away by Shinkansen. It's like, oh.
Yeah. Well, there's I'll get to that. So I had, like, one day layover between my flight to Tokyo and then a flight from Tokyo to Fukuoka. And so we determined that it was actually cheaper to stay in Tokyo for one night because the price of the flight went down and get a hotel in the area. I had a friend from Scotland who was used to be on the Ys forums, and she was studying in Okayama, which is way out in the middle of nowhere. But she was on vacation in Tokyo for, like, 2 weeks or something like that. She met me in Tokyo, and the one day, like, the half a day that I had in Tokyo, we went to game stores in Akihabara, and I spent, like, $500 on the first day. Like, I bought a Duo, and I bought, like, everything Castlevania I could find and everything Ys that I could find, and just, like, loaded up and then crammed all of that in my suitcase and then made my flight on to Fukuoka. And when I got to Fukuoka, I was surprised to find the company that I was studying Japanese with, their, like, the little school, had their school offices. Like, they had the school was in a building on the second floor of the Mandarake building. So, Mandarake being, like, a huge, like, you know, game and otaku culture store. Okay.
Yeah.
So, I could go at lunch. I could take lunch and go downstairs into Mandarake and shop video games in, like, this huge selection of video games, literally just walking down the steps. And so, I bought so much crap. I probably bought, like, $2,000 worth of stuff over that two-month period. And what I found was that Fukuoka actually had a really good video game market, and it was a lot cheaper than Tokyo. So I came back with a ton of stuff. I came back with Dracula X. I came back with, you know, the Ys games. I came back with the Valus games. I mean, I came back with a ton of good stuff. And so there I was. I'm now a PC Engine fanatic. And then the PC, the Duo dies. And so for, like, that whole year, I spent that entire year playing all of my PC Engine games on either Magic Engine or Wii. And I ripped them all and put them on a hard drive and used the Wii emulators to play them. And that's how I played PC Engine for that whole year. And then when I came back to Japan, I bought another system and left that broken Duo back home and eventually sold it off.
Nice.
But, like, that's my experience with PC Engine. And Ys was kind of the thing that drew me into that. But I don't think I would have played it without that. That or Castlevania. So, really, Castlevania is the gateway into PC Engine for a lot of people. Thank you for listening to part one of our in-depth dive into the world of PC Engine. Next time, we're going to talk about Atlantean, the first PC Engine cue card game made in 20 years. And some wild and woolly stories about that, let me tell you. So, as always, this is Doors and Dungeons. And you can find us on Twitter. It's at DoorDunPodcast. At DoorDunPodcast. Also, we have Patreon, as always, in which you can sign up and give a little bit. Even just $1 will help. Anything will help. I want to try and turn this into a slightly more full-time thing so that I can really devote a lot more time and energy into it. So, you know, help out in any way you can. That would be awesome. And then, of course, the book should be getting out there before too long. And by too long, I mean, we'll see. A few months, I think, at the most. And then, also, we have a new Discord server. So, this Discord server is open to anybody. I will have an invite in the links. And I would love for you to just come in and chat. Tell me about what you think, what you'd like to hear about on the podcast, and just talk to other listeners. And that sort of fun stuff. Also, I have an Instagram account. So if you just search for Doors and Dungeons on Instagram, you can find out all kinds of cool videos and posts and, you know, pictures from my gaming collection and just, you know, random stuff. So please join up with that. And we will see you next time on part 2, Atlantean.